I'm Professor Walter Williams, John M. Olin Distinguished Professor of Economics at George Mason University. While teaching economics to our students, undergraduates and graduate students, I am also involved in trying to do research on the growth of government and the kind of threat that it poses for our individual freedom.
Walter, how do you balance this? What seems to be two activities, the research activity and the teaching activity?
Well, it's not easy. I have to allocate my time efficiently. The research activities occur mostly in the mornings from 4 o'clock until around 10 o'clock. And then I take roughly about an hour or two to write a syndicated column that is published nationally across our country. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, I allocate that time to teaching activities.
You said 4 a.m.?
Yes.
You take naps, or is...
Well, once in a while, I'm afforded the luxury of taking a nap, say, around 1 o'clock for an hour, and that rejuvenates me, and then I get up and I get my nose back to the grindstone.
Insight Magazine selected you as one of the 10 best college teachers in the United States. Why do you feel you're successful in the classroom?
Well, first of all, I'm very flattered by Insight, and I'm not quite sure how they reached that conclusion, but I will accept their flattering article. I think that the major contribution that I have to teaching, and I consider my teaching not only in the classroom, but to Americans in general through my syndicated column, and then once in a while I have the opportunity to teach the Congress of the United States. And I think that my forte in teaching is to be able to explain things to people who have never taken a course in economics so that they understand it. There are many, many complex things in economics, but a professor's job is to make those things comprehensible to the average individual.
And are you considered an easy teacher, a tough teacher?
Well, I rank fairly hard. I rank fairly high in the in student rankings. I think that I'm normally considered a tough but fair teacher. After all, I think that we should demand things of our young people because they're not really being challenged enough in our educational system.
Obviously, you have an impact. Teachers can play a really significant role in students' lives. Did you have any teachers in high school or college that particularly impressed you?
Well, yes. I believe that there's one teacher that might have made a very, very important difference in my life. It was Dr. Rosenberg at Benjamin Franklin High School in North Philadelphia, where I attended during 1950 to 1954. And one morning, he laid me out pretty good. I had answered a question, and I made a comment underneath my breath loud enough for him to hear it, and he began to read me the Riot Act, saying in very, very poetic ways that Williams, teaching you this material is like casting pearl into the swine. And he made some other disparaging comments, and that was my first real challenge in high school. And after he insulted me, what I considered insulted me, that gave me incentive to pull myself up in the eyes of my teachers. Also, at UCLA, I encountered some very, very dedicated men like Professor Armin Alshin, Professor Axel Laniford, and Professor William Allen. And those men, they saw my academic deficiencies, and they challenged, and they gave of their own personal time to help me lift myself above those academic deficiencies.
Were you at any point in your college career or high school career, were you considered a top student?
I doubt it. It seemed to me that being a student or becoming a scholar was always a struggle. That is, I had to put in a whole lot of time and a whole lot of effort, and I had to do things many, many times over and over again. Now, I believe that characterizes most of us who become scholars or academicians. We have to put in a whole lot of time. We have to put in a whole lot of time just to reach mediocrity, and if you're going to go beyond that, it means even more time and effort.
You went from Philadelphia to California, high school to college. What led to that move? Was there any person or incident that took you across the country?
Well, I guess the major draw was that I found that I could go to school relatively cheap, cheaply in California as compared to Philadelphia. And then I saw Philadelphia as a losing proposition. I had a lot of aspirations, but they just could not be fulfilled. And so when I got out of the Army in 1961, my wife and I, we managed to save $700, and we just hitched up a U-Haul trailer to my 1951 Mercury, and we drove to California, never looking back, and actually never really anticipating coming back to Philadelphia. And I started school in California, my wife got a job, and I went to school continuously for 10 and a half years. But ultimately, I did come back to Philadelphia, and I took a job at Temple University, and I live in the Philadelphia area now.
In between high school and college, did you, in addition to the armed forces, did you have any jobs?
Yes, I did. I had many jobs. I worked as a shipper for a textile a wholesaler. One job, which is very colorful, I was a taxi cab driver in Philadelphia from 1957 until 1959, and then for 6 months after I left the Army. And being a taxi driver was a fairly good education, as well as a very, very good income-earning experience or opportunity.
Was there a particular person who persuaded you to study economics?
Well, yes, there was, and that person was not alive. It was W.E.B. Du Bois. I was a sociology major during my freshman and sophomore years in college at California State University. And over the summer, I read W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction. And somewhere in there, he says that blacks are never going to significantly move up the economic ladder until they learn how to do something with the economic system. And I'm merely paraphrasing what he said, but that caused some thoughts in my mind. And when school opened up that September, I changed my major to economics, which turned out to be quite a struggle because economics is far more demanding than sociology. One had to learn how to engage in deductive logic. One had to learn some statistics and math and straight thinking, which is not necessarily a great demand in sociology.
So your approach to economics, based on your personal background and your readings of Du Bois, led you to approach it as something that might be helpful to you as a black, and perhaps to understand the dilemma of other blacks. Were you surprised at what you found in economics?
Well, it's pretty hard to remember, but surely some surprises were things like I thought that the minimum wage, for example, which I do a lot of research on, I thought that the minimum wage, like many, many other Americans who have not really thought about it, was a really good idea, was a good way to help the poor. And it was a real eye-opener after I took economics that the minimum wage was perhaps one of the most devastating things that you could do to poor or low-skilled workers. And so I thought that increasing government control would be a good thing or a helpful thing to people in general. And it was a shock to me as a young economics student to learn that government is the cause of many of our problems as opposed to being the solution to those problems. So there were indeed shocks. I had to rethink ideas, and in many cases, rethinking those ideas were uncomfortable and sometimes unpleasant experience.
Well, in the United States today, in 1987, race still influences people's behavior. How do you deal with the problem?
Well, I'm not quite sure whether I have a program for dealing with the problem, but I know that while race has been an important detriment to blacks in general historically, I doubt whether it is an important or as important detriment today. I think for all intents and purposes in the United States that blacks do have their constitutional guarantees, and the problems that blacks face today are not really race. That is, the civil rights struggle is over and won in the United States, which doesn't mean that that all the problems have come to an end, but what it does mean is that they're not civil rights problems.
Civil rights in the sense of status within the law and within society.
That's right. That is absolutely right. And I'm not denying the existence of discrimination, but what I hold and what my colleague Tom Sowell holds is that discrimination just cannot explain all of what we see. It has nowhere the explanatory power that it used to have.
What was your most upsetting confrontation with racism?
Well, I guess it was while I was in the Army. I was drafted and I was sent to first to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and to Fort Stewart, Georgia, and I had considerable difficulties adjusting to the Southern way of life, I had many fights on base. Maybe many is too strong a word. Maybe about four or five. I had many confrontations with lawyers. I had a special courts martial, which I won, by the way. And eventually, the conflict led to my being sent to Korea as a way of getting rid of me. Now, a lot of those confrontations that I encountered were, you can call them, self-inflicted. This is back in 1959 and 60, recall, that when I was in the Army. And I used to organize the black soldiers to go to the dance on the wrong night. That is, they had on the Army post, they had a white dance and a black dance. Well, I organized the black soldiers to go to the white dance. And when one of my colleagues asked the young lady for a dance, the dance was called an end, and there was a lot of problems that led to my being charged with inciting the riot. But also I challenged my duties as a soldier in light of the fact that I did not have constitutional guarantees. So had I remained quiet at Fort Stewart, I would not have encountered nearly as many problems as I did. But I decided to rock the boat. Now, looking back on the situation where I got a lot of threats, fellows telling me not to come off the post or telling me that the Ku Klux Klan would be waiting for me. But looking back on the situation, I would have never done it. Because when you're young, you tend to think that you're invincible. But when you get older, you can recognize that one of those fellows could have taking me to the Okefenokee swamps down there, and I would have never been heard of afterwards.
Well, we're pleased that you survived that experience. How does it affect your approach to economics?
Well, I don't think that has any particular connection to my approach to economics. I think that what I do as a scientist, and I believe it's all scientists' obligation, is to ask questions about what, how, when, and if, and those kind of questions, to separate subjective issues out of away from objective issues. So as an economist, I can ask, well, what is the effect of doing such and such? Without asking whether the result or whether the act is good or bad, just ask what is the effect. And you're very much like a physicist. A physicist would ask, what is the independent influence of gravity on a falling object? He doesn't ask, he doesn't say whether gravity is good or bad. He just asks, what is the effect? Now that's the job of an economist. You say, well, if government legislates a minimum wage law, what is the effect? Or if government regulates oil prices, what are the effects? And so I believe that the duty of an economist is to supply policymakers with objective findings so that the policymakers can make judgments based on what they might consider what's good or bad.
Well, in that context, is do you think economics is more or less revealing of human behavior than sociology, for example, where you started your education?
Yes, I do. I think that the basic laws of supply and demand govern all of our behavior, and I think that knowing something about economics can teach something systemically important about human behavior, namely that we all face constraints imposed on us by scarcity, and that we all seek to maximize those kind of things that we want. Now, just knowing those two things, you can predict a whole lot about human behavior, much more so than a sociologist who tries to get into a person's mind and act as if intentions, commitment, obligations, and those kind of things determine human behavior. Just for example, one can say, well, if the price of something goes down, people will do more of it. If the price of something goes up, people will do less of it. Now, that's a very, very simple principle, but it's very, very powerful in its predictive capability. For example, dealing with crime. That is, we know that criminals also respond to the law of demand. That is, if crime costs are low, then we expect a lot of crime. If crime costs are very high, we expect less crime. Now, so the way an economist would approach crime would be to raise the cost of committing crime or raise the probability of becoming, of being convicted if you commit a crime. Now, a sociologist might go the other way. He might want to sit down and tell a person, well, it's not a good idea to rob a bank. Well, he's absolutely wrong from an economic standpoint. That is, if you can get away with robbing a bank, that's a good idea because you have much more money than you get from working. Now, so just the vision of the way an economist approaches problems is entirely different from sociologists, and I think that is a more fruitful approach.
You mentioned scarcity. Is scarcity ever eliminated?
No way. Scarcity is never eliminated. That is, there's only a finite amount of everything here on Earth. There's a finite amount of coal, there's a finite amount of land, there's a finite amount of time, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't eliminate scarcity. What people do, they try to accommodate their lives considering the existence of scarcity. So now scarcity is to be distinguished from shortages. Shortages are something that happens because government imposes price controls or other kinds of regulations. So shortages can be eliminated by raising the price, or surpluses can be eliminated by lowering prices, but you can never get rid of scarcity. Scarcity is that punishment that was imposed upon us when we disgraced ourselves in the Garden of Eden.
But if I understand right, though, scarcity we adjust to ourselves, and supply and demand kind of deals with scarcity. Is that correct?
And that is absolutely right.
But shortage, when you say shortage, supply and demand cannot deal with that because, in a sense, the market is not being allowed to function, which is what creates the shortage.
That is absolutely right. That is, for example, New York is a classic example. Or let's say rent control is a classic example. In New York, they have rent controls. In Washington, D.C., they have rent controls. The predictable consequence of rent controls, wherever they're enacted, is that they create shortages in housing. They create shortages in one way, that people at the controlled price, they want more housing than they would have wanted at the market price. And then, in addition to that, since landlords cannot make what they consider a fair rate of return on their investment, they withdraw capital from the market, withdraw some of their housing from the market, and that contributes to the shortage. For example, in New York, according to one estimate that I read, approximately 30,000 housing units are abandoned each year. That is, landlords, they use up the house, that is, they don't make improvements, and so when it becomes uninhabitable, they just abandon it. Now, and it's tragic because New York land is some of the most valuable land in the world, and yet you have a set of circumstances that would encourage land owners just to walk away and leave a building. So holding prices down is the best way to get a shortage. On the other hand, the best way to get a surplus is to have price floors, such as we have in agriculture. That is, we give farmers a higher price for their product through various government programs than what the market will generate. And so, of course, farmers will produce more, they'll use their land more productively. And you'll see shortages. You'll see mountains of oranges. You'll see mountains of cheese, mountains of butter, and mountains of all kinds of goods. And it applies in the United States, and it also applies in the European communities that have these subsidies for farmers. I'd like to add, it applies to even human behavior. That is, basically, when you tax something, you get less of it. When you subsidize something, you get more of it. I don't care whether you're talking about subsidizing wheat or subsidizing slovenly behavior. That is, if we have welfare programs, we have unemployment compensation, well, you'd expect to see more people on welfare. Expect to see more slovenly behavior if you subsidize it. You'll see more people choosing unemployment rather than taking the first job that comes along if you have very, very remunerative or attractive unemployment compensation. It's a basic principle of human behavior.
With regard to the rent control, what happens in the situation where there is no rent control, and how does the landlord then adjust to the deterioration of his building in such a way that leads him not to abandon it?
Well, if there's no rent control, landlords will charge the rent that will cover the operating costs and also cover depreciation expenses. That is, a landlord acting rationally, he will put part of the rent towards making improvements and repairs in the building. Okay, now if there's rent control, well, that reduces the value of maintaining his capital in a particular form. That is, it reduces the value of keeping his building so that it can produce useful housing services. Now, in the absence of rent controls, landlords like you and I will take care of things. When you have rent controls, they'll have incentive to do other things. But beyond that, human beings are very, very imaginative. That is, when you have rent controls, people will seek ways around the rent controls. For example, in New York and other places where they have rent controls, renters will voluntarily pay under the table payments to the landlord, or the landlord will charge them extra for services and he'll charge them extra rental prices for furniture if it's a furnished place. So what I'm saying is that human beings always have the incentive to try to maximize what we call utility in economics, which is nothing more than satisfaction. And so they will try to find ways around government. If they can't find ways around government, then you'll find those kind of things that we see in New York, the massive abandonment of housing.
Can you be thought of as belonging to a particular school of economics, a particular approach?
Well, I don't identify with any particular school. I'm rather eclectic in my approach. There's the so-called Chicago School of Economics, led by Milton Friedman and George Stigler. And then there's the Virginia or Public Choice School of Economics, led by my colleague, Professor Jim Buchanan. And then there are Austrians, led by Friedrich Hayek. Now, I'm not wedded to any particular set of theories. I just look at what each school has to contribute to economics, and perhaps skim, if you will. That is, take the best of what these different schools offer in terms of approaches to economic problems.
What's your primary interest?
Well, as I said at the introduction, my primary interest is to examine the role and the increasing role that government is playing in all of our lives. Now, so that allows me to look at a whole lot of things. It allows me to look at government's role in taxing. It allows me to look at government's role in regulation and government's role in the provision of certain services such as schools. And it's kind of an entree into many different subjects just by having interest in the expansive role of government in our society allows me to examine many issues, including minimum wage, labor laws, Davis-Bacon Act, and all these other kinds of regulations.
Well, government intervention, as I understand it, is justified on the basis that the free market tends to be abusive. What's your response to that?
Well, that is absolutely nonsense. That's really turning the state of affairs on its head. That is, throughout human history, government has been an enemy of man. That is, no one, if you had to list the major abuses of man in his history, it's always done at the hands of government. I don't care whether you're talking about Nazi persecution of Jews, or you're talking about slavery in America, or you're talking about the Maoist or Stalinist purges. It's all government as the major oppressor of human beings. Now, on the other hand, if you look at what are the kinds of things that free individuals, it has to be the market, that is, open markets without government interference. That is, in the market, people get rich or people do well by serving their fellow man. And matter of fact, that's how you know, when you see a rich person, most of the times that means that he has pleased his fellow man. For example, let's take just a few examples, such as Michael Jackson. Why does Michael Jackson make more money than I do? Well, he pleases more of his fellow men than I do. That is, people like his singing. Or you take Levi Strauss. Levi Strauss became a rich man. He pleased his fellow man. Now, in a free market, the route to riches comes through, for the most part, through pleasing your fellow man. Now, before we had a market economy in the world, the route to riches was by looting and plundering and raping your fellow man. That was the way you became rich. So there's a morality of the free market. That is, the free market suggests voluntary exchange. And what voluntary exchange really means is that, look, you say to a person, if you make me feel good, I'll make you feel good. That's what voluntary exchange is. Or you can look at voluntary exchange as seduction, if you like that word better. That is, two people trying to make one another feel good. for their own advantage. For example, let me give you a case. Now, when I go into my grocery store with $2 in my hand, I tell the grocer, look, if you make me feel good, give me that bottle of milk, I'll make you feel good, give you the $2. Now, when there's seduction or voluntary exchange, both parties are better off in their own estimation. That is, the grocer gains in his opinion, and I gain in my opinion. Now, the basis of government, or the essence of government, is rape, involuntary exchange. That is, and you can look at involuntary exchange as I said, rape. That is, where you actually tell your fellow man, unless you make me feel good, I'm going to make you feel badly. And that would be the case where I walked into the grocer with a gun in my hand, and I said to him, unless you make me feel good, give me the gallon of milk, I'm going to make you feel bad, blow your brains out. Now, with involuntary exchange or rape-type exchange, in order for one person to be better off, it of necessity requires that the other person be worse off. Now, government all over the world is the major source of organized rape. That is, government tells people, unless you make me feel good, or unless you make somebody I work for feel good, we're going to make you feel bad. For example, the government tells you and I that unless we make, through the tax code, the farmers feel good by giving them some of our earnings as crop subsidies, the government's going to make us feel bad, put us in jail because of violation of the tax code. So what I'm saying is that the free market is moral because it promotes voluntary exchange. And in the free market, there's what economists call, or statisticians call, a positive-sum game. That is, the agents or the actors are all better off.
But the argument is made that as an individual, perhaps with little education, I'm in a bad position to defend myself against the wealth and power of a big corporation, which results from this market exchange.
Well, that's utter nonsense. Ask yourself, or we should all ask ourselves. You take a big corporation like Chrysler or Exxon. What kind of control in a free market would Exxon or Chrysler have over you and I? That is, in order for Chrysler to get dollars from me, I have to voluntarily give Chrysler dollars. I have to get out of my chair. I have to go down to the showroom and voluntarily give the man $10,000 for his car. I can give it to him or I cannot give it to them. Now, that voluntariness does not explain our relationship with government. That is, government can get dollars from us whether we choose to give it to them or not. They can just send agents and just confiscate our money. Now, in other words, Chrysler can charge whatever price they want for their car, or Exxon can charge whatever price they want, but I decide how much gasoline or how many Chryslers I'm going to buy at that price. So what is the meaning when you say that Chrysler, some big corporation, has power over me? It doesn't have any power at all. But I might add that Chrysler can get my dollars whether I want to give it to them or not, but first they have to go to Washington. For example, Lee Iacocca, he could have stopped by my house and he could say, William, you know, back when Chrysler was having problems, when they needed the bailout, or farmers who are having problems right now. Farmers or Lee Iacocca, they could stop by my house and they could say, Williams, I'm having trouble. Can you lend me a dime? Now, Lee Iacocca or the farmers, if they came to my house, I would probably tell them to go play in the traffic. Now, they know that. So what they do, they get on the train or on planes and they go talk to their congressman. They say, Senator so-and-so, I need some money. If I go to Williams and ask him to voluntarily help me out, he's going to tell me to go play in the traffic. So could you use your agents to confiscate Williams's money? So what I'm saying with that little scenario there, that is, businesses can have power over us, but they must acquire that power through the political process. They must go to Washington and use the power of government to rape us, if you will.
Well, let me develop a different scenario. You come to my door, and I'm white, you're black, and you say, sir, I want to buy your house. And I say to you, look, I won't sell my house to anyone who's black. Now, isn't that a negative outcome of a market?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that is, I mean, I could walk up to some white girl walk along the street and I say, well, look, lady, I want to marry you and you ought to give me equal opportunity. She said, well, look, I don't marry blacks. Or a white lady could come up to me and say, and ask me to marry her. I can say, look, I don't marry white ladies. Now, so what you're really talking about is freedom of choice. That is, I believe that you have the right to sell your house to whomever you please. I have the right to sell my house to whomever you please. Now, I don't believe you have the right to use the coercive powers of government to force your neighbor through law or through intimidation to sell his house to who you think he should sell his house to. Now, just looking at housing discrimination, for example, I think it's a very interesting example of the market. In the United States, there's been discrimination against blacks, but a lot of times you saw restrictive covenant laws, or you saw other kinds of intimidation, other intimidation against blacks from buying houses in certain areas, violent intimidation. Now, ask yourself, if white people would not sell their houses to blacks, why would you need a law? I mean, the very existence of a law suggests that there are people around that would not act according to the way the law specifies. So there's a real question of whether you, Bob Chittister, would sell the house, would refuse to sell the house to me. Economic theory says that there exists a price whereby you will sell the house to me. Now, maybe I don't want to go as high, I don't want to make the price that high, but there exists a price. Basic economics tells us that. And furthermore, I might add that if you look at cities like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, in the 1920s, before we even had an Equal Housing Act, whole neighborhoods were going from white to black virtually overnight, and nobody could stop it. That is, Harlem became a predominantly black neighborhood before there was any EEOC, before there was HUD, before there was any of these anti-discrimination laws. That is, the market took care of much of this problem. The market made discrimination very costly.
What limits, if any, would you set on the exercise of these private property rights, if you would?
Well, I would probably set very, very few limits. That is, and we really have to talk about, I'll just briefly mention what property rights are. Property rights are the right to keep, acquire, and dispose of property that's left in the hands of the owner of the property. Now, part of my property right, let's say if I own a house, means that you cannot run your car through my house because I own the house. Even though you own the car, it means that you cannot infringe upon my property rights. So what I'm saying is that as long as individuals do not infringe upon the property rights of others, I would say they have the right to use their property any way they want to.
Well, why is private property so important?
Well, private property is very, very, very important because it forces all of us to take into account our private or our current decisions on the future values of things. For example, I think that it is a good idea that houses be available for future generations. let's say the kid that's going to be born in 2050 or 2075, it's probably a good idea that houses be around for him to live in. Now, the fact that I privately own my property forces me to take into account the effect of my current decisions on the life of my house. Now, the way that it forces me to do that is that if I don't make the necessary repairs to maintain my house, well, my house is going to deteriorate, and the selling price that I can get for my house is going to be very, very low. But if I take care of my house to ensure that it will provide housing services for many, many years, well, then the selling price of my house is going to be very, very high. Now, so through private property rights and the right to transfer without interference, it holds our personal wealth, as my colleague Armin Alshan says quite frequently, it holds our personal wealth hostage to our doing the right thing. Now, ask yourself, well, would people have the same kind of incentives to maintain their property or maintain a piece of property if the government owned the property? Or would they have the same kind of incentives to maintain property if there were a 75% tax on the property when you went to sell it? No, they wouldn't. And so what I'm saying in a nutshell is that private property forces people to do socially responsible things. And matter of fact, some of our greatest problems are in areas where things aren't held privately. That is, we hear all kinds of statements. People are worried about the extinction of the elephant. They're worried about the extinction of the whale. They have clubs, Ducks Unlimited, worrying about certain kinds of ducks. Now, I haven't heard a single person form a group worrying about the extinction of pigs and sheep and chickens and cows. Now, why not? Well, in the case of eagles and buffaloes, it is in no individual's personal private interest to spend a lot of resources making sure that buffaloes and eagles are well cared for. But however, it is in somebody's personal private interest to make sure that chickens and cows or sheep are taken care of properly or used wisely. So even in that area, we find that private property plays a great role. If you look around, ask yourselves, if you're driving along the highway and look at those shiny trucks. If you see a very shiny truck, very well taken care of truck, cared for truck, it's most likely that that truck is owner operated. And you see an old raggedy truck, it's one that where the driver is just an employer of the company. If you look at who takes care of a house, if you ask the question, who takes care of a house better, a renter or an owner? Well, clearly, an owner has a vested stake in taking care of the property. A renter has a reduced set of incentives for taking care of the property. So private property plays a very, very important role in conserving on the scarce resources of our society.
But an issue that has always confused and troubled us is that you and I and six other people have our houses on this street. We own them. We're struggling to keep them in good condition because we want to get a good return when we sell them. And Joe across the street suddenly falls on hard times or whatever, and the first thing we know, we have a real eyesore in our neighborhood. Well, how do we deal with that in the marketplace? Do we all have to get together and buy it? Gee, we can't afford that.
Sure, that's one alternative, is to buy the house. But and clearly, that's a very, very realistic alternative. But what we see in neighborhoods all around the country is that that institutions are formed to get people to what economists call their $2 words, to internalize externalities. That is, we get our neighbors to care for their property by saying, well, if the neighbor doesn't mow his lawn and do those kind of socially accepted things, we won't allow them in the country club. We won't allow our children to play with them. And we take other sanctions against people. And normally, the people that don't cooperate, and normally this works. Now, in the case where a person is letting his property run down, well, surely there's one alternative is to walk up to him and say, well, look, hey, how about taking care of your property a little bit better? Or to maybe help him. There's been a spirit of cooperation through most of our history in the United States. And finally, buy the house from him or buy the property and somebody else will and sell it to somebody that will take care of it. I don't see that as a very, very significant, a very, very serious problem. In most neighborhoods, there's a considerable socioeconomic status homogeneity, and people tend to share the same values. So I don't see that as much of a problem.
Do you agree with the correlation that is suggested between economic freedom and personal and political freedom?
Oh, yes. I don't believe one can exist or thrive very well without the other. I think that personal freedom in a very, very important way is economic freedom. That is, a component of my personal freedom is to be able to set up contracts with whomever I please on a mutually agreeable basis. That's a personal freedom, but it's also an economic freedom. So I think it's a rather artificial to separate them. That is, I mean, I own Walter Williams, and I should have the rights to use my body and use me, Walter Williams, any way I please. Now, that is, I have the right to use it to, if you want to hire me to drive you from place to place, or if you want to hire me to tutor your children. Now, I have the right to do that if I own me. Now, so, is that a personal freedom or is it an economic freedom? Well, one can make a case that it's components of both in there.
But let's take freedom of religion. How is that dependent on free market capitalism, for example?
Well, I think that it's something that comes readily to mind. If the government owned all the churches, if the government owned the printing presses to print hymn books, how much religious freedom could you have?
Well, aren't human rights as important as freedom?
Well, human rights are the same as freedom. That is, what I'm saying is I think that people artificially separate these two. That is, a human right is the right for me to be able to enter into contractual agreements with others, the right to be able to use my house, to have access to my house, a right to buy whatever shoes I want. Now, that's a human right. It's also a personal freedom. It's also an economic freedom. So I think that it's a very, very false distinction to that leads to statements like that you hear in the political arenas that when, for example, people say, well, when property rights interferes with human rights, well, then property rights have to give way. Well, human rights are property rights. That is, I own myself, and that's a property right. And I ought to be free to do with myself as I please. That's a property right, but you might want to call it a human right as well. So it's an artificial distinction. I believe that they're only property rights or that they're only human rights, but they both are part and parcel of the same thing.
But there are those who would argue that it isn't enough to have the freedom to work, that one also ought to have the right to a job, for example.
Well, that's utter nonsense. That is, let's say the right to a particular job. That is, when you say that, for example, I'm going to hire a domestic servant, and somebody says, "Well, Williams, I have a right to work for you." Well, that's saying to me that I don't have a right to say that you will not work for me. Now, so I think what you have to carefully distinguish, you have to carefully acknowledge is that when we talk about rights, we're talking about those things held simultaneously by all people. What I mean by that is the right to free speech, my right to free speech, in no way reduces or attenuates your right to free speech. But when someone says that I have a right to eat, or I have a right to food, or I have a right to housing, well, what that means is that you do not have a right to a certain amount of your income, because in order for me to get food or housing, the government has to take away something that belongs to you, which of necessity reduces your property rights, and give it to me. So our rights do not exist simultaneously. And the same thing applies to when you say that a person has a right to a job. I think what you need to say is that a person has a right to enter into contracts with other individuals at mutually advantageous or mutually agreeable terms. They do not have a right to a particular job.
You've said that government could give every poor person in America, I think the figure is about $10,000 cash a year. How? How can that?
Well, that can be seen, and it's a lot of debate on the particular amount, but it's roughly in the right neighborhood. That is, if you add up all the money in the United States, if you add up all the money spent in the United States at the federal, state, and local levels of government that have as their full justification or part justification coping with some aspect of poverty, if you add up all that money, and you just simply divided the number of poor people into that total amount, you could give them, if you just gave them the money, which I'm not proposing, if you just gave them the money, you could give each poor family of four somewhere between $36,000 to $40,000. Now, I think that that is very instructive of what is happening in the so-called poverty programs. That is, poor people are being used as stalking horses to conceal the income objectives of other people. That is, we know that poor families of four are not getting $36,000 to $40,000 a year. So if they're not getting the money that's allocated to the poor through various governments, well then non-poor people must be getting it. Either poor, or there's either poor people or non-poor people. Now, considerable evidence suggests that many, many non-poor people are getting the money in their roles as GS-15s, GS-16s, managing these projects, professors or other individuals doing studies on poverty and getting, you know, $300,000 and $400,000 million grants to do studies on poverty, and perhaps having meetings in Miami in the winter to talk about the poor at some very nice hotel. What I'm saying is that poor people are being used to conceal the income objectives of other people, and the very fact that they're not, we have this huge bundle of money allocated to poverty programs, and the very fact that poor people are not receiving it suggests just that.
Well, what about socialism? Why don't we simply go to socialism and divide up all the money evenly?
Well, socialism has not worked in solving the problems of human beings wherever it has existed. Matter of fact, even in the United States, at the early part of our history, we had an experiment with socialism, and we found that it did not work. If you look around the world and you ask the question, where are men freer? Where are people freer? Where do they have the highest income? You'll see it in those places that have some semblance of a market system. You will see the greatest human oppression in the world under those governments that call themselves communist or very, very socialistic governments. I'm talking about Russia, China, most of the continent of Africa. And Africa is a very, very instructive place. That is, during colonial periods, a lot of Africa was could be characterized as more market-oriented than government intervention, which is the necessary consequence of socialism or communism. Now, after independence, the governments of Africa bought the siren song of socialism and communism. And we've seen after that time that the countries have become poorer and poorer. A classic example is Ghana. Ghana was the richest country in Africa at independence. Now Ghana is one of the poorest countries on the continent of Africa. Now, what I just want to say is that if you take the International Amnesty's book of human rights abuses, and if you take per capita income, and if you make some kind of scale saying that, you know, ranking countries from socialism to socialistic or through the spectrum towards capitalistic, what you'll find that the countries that rank the highest on International Amnesty's human rights protections tend more towards being the capitalistic or market-oriented countries. Also, you'll find that the countries that rank the highest in terms of human rights protections, they are also those countries where per capita income are the highest. On the other hand, the poorest countries in the world have the poorest records of human rights abuses, human rights protection. They have the lowest income, and they tend to be the most socialistic. It's no coincidence. I mean, you compare Hong Kong with mainland China, East Germany with West Germany, you compare Canada, you compare South Korea with North Korea, Taiwan with China, and there's example after example all over the world of the failure of socialism to deliver on its promises.
You've spent a good deal of time in the School of Hard Knocks, obviously, as well as in intellectual pursuits. Do you at this point come to the conclusion that maybe Americans are getting too soft to compete in a competitive marketplace?
Well, it's a mixed story whether Americans are getting too soft. I think that Americans are the most ingenious, robust, imaginative people on the face of Earth. But I think at the same time, many Americans have bought this siren song that government can take care of things. But the tide is changing. That is, more and more Americans are recognizing that government, far from being the solution to problems, is indeed the cause of problems. Now, so what I'm saying is that what Americans need right now are the same kind of things that they had when we were developing into the world's greatest power, both militarily and economically. That is, we had considerable amounts of economic freedom, and our government played a very, very small role in our lives. And anybody who's interested can look at the role that federal government played in our lives. That is, the federal government spending as a percentage of the GNP never exceeded 4% of the GNP except during war times. Now federal government spending is roughly 30% of the GNP, suggesting this greater and greater role that government is playing in our lives. I think Americans can outcompete anybody in the world. You can look at it in terms of our productive output, and you can look at it in terms of our intellectual output. That is, Americans pick up the Nobel Prizes, almost all of the Nobel Prizes, and they've been doing so since roughly 1940. So freedom, the kind of freedom that we have in America, not only means that we can grow as a rich country in terms of material goods, it also says that we can grow intellectually, because competition in the marketplace produces superior products, just as competition in the marketplace of ideas, that's what I meant to say, produces superior ideas, just as competition in the marketplace of goods and services produces superior goods and services.